You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative talents at one of the world's great opera companies. For additional podcast interviews, subscribe to our RSS feed or visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Nicole Cabell, tenor Eric Cutler, baritone Nathan Gunn, and conductor John Mauchery are backstage at Lyric.
It's such a famous duet, and people who really love it, you can hear it throughout the entire piece in different places. I was one of those people at the beginning, the first time, you know, I started, you know, studying opera and I heard that duet, I thought, wow. You know, it's always the Merrill Beerling recording. You're just like, holy smokes, this is gorgeous.
I wish I could sound like Beerling.
What's the rest of that opera sound like? You know, what's interesting now is that, you know, my ears have adjusted so much. They've changed after having sung it that I don't hear it in the same way anymore. And for me, it's turned into this story. And it's not just a beautiful tune. It's a coming together of two men that are separated for so long. It's a reaffirmation of vows, and it's a reliving of the experience that caused the strife at the beginning. And if you think about what they're saying, you can see how that takes place.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for the Pearl Fishers. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening of the production. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We include all of the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Nicole Cabell, Eric Cutler, Nathan Gunn, and John Mauchery. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it. Good evening, and welcome to our Discovery Series session on the Pearl Fishers. I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera Chicago. We have our soprano, tenor, baritone, and conductor with us this evening to explain in no uncertain terms that this has a great deal more to offer its audience than just the duet. They're all Americans, but they're going to prove in this production that they have all achieved absolute command of the romantic French style. Nicole Cabell is returning to Lyric as Leila after portraying Musetta in La Bohème here last season. Internationally, in recent years, she's become one of the most successful alumni of Lyric's Ryan Opera Center. Following her victory in the 2005 BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition, she's been heard at Covent Garden, the Deutsche Oper Berlin, the Opéra de Montpellier, and the Edinburgh Festival, as well as with major orchestras worldwide. This season, she makes her eagerly awaited debut at the Metropolitan Opera as Pamina in the Magic Flute, and sings Adina in Elisir d'Amore there as well, and she also sings her first Figaro Countess at Cincinnati Opera. Eric Cutler, who was previously with us as Ferrando in Così fan tutte, is returning as Nadir in Pearl Fishers. Among his other successes in French opera have been La Juive at the Met, Io Passo in Les Troyens in Paris, and both Nadir and Romeo at Opera Australia in Sydney. This season brings him to Amsterdam for I Puritani, Houston for Rigoletto, and Paris for Szymanowski's King Roger. He's an alumnus of the Met's Young Artist Program who now sings leading roles there, including Arturo on DVD in the company's production of I Puritani. Nathan Gunn, who's singing Zurga, was with us for Così fan tutte, singing Guglielmo. He debuted with us as Billy Budd and returned as Anthony in Sweeney Todd and last season as Rossini's Figaro. He spent last summer at Glyndebourne singing the world premiere of Peter Utvös's Love and Other Demons. This season in Houston, he'll star in a world premiere based on a movie that probably a lot of you are familiar with, and that is Brief Encounter, written by Jake Heggie. Pearl Fishers is a work he sung in Philadelphia and Detroit. He starred in Paris, London, Munich, Brussels, as well as at the Met and in every other major American house. His recording of Billy Budd was released just a few weeks ago. John Mocheri has appeared with us previously conducting Romeo et Juliette, Regina, and La Boheme. He's conducted at the Met and the other major American houses, as well as at La Scala, Covent Garden, Deutsche Oper Berlin, among many other companies, and with the major orchestras of Berlin, Leipzig, London, Rome, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and Cleveland. He's amassed a very large discography, including Porgy and Bess, Regina, which he edited and restored, for several performances with Decca's Invaluable and Arte der Musik series, including a real rarity, Korngold's Das Wunder der Heliane. He holds the position of chancellor at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and he's a newly appointed consultant with Walt Disney Educational Productions. So please welcome to the Discovery Series Nicole Cabell, Eric Cutler, Nathan Gunn, and John Mocheri. Okay, 60-second synopsis, here we go. In ancient Ceylon, Nadir, a fisherman, returns to the pearl fishers' community after a long absence and is reunited with his friend Zurga, their newly elected leader. Zurga and Nadir recall that in the past they had both loved a priestess, Layla, and for the sake of their friendship had sworn to never see her again. When Nadir observes Layla praying, however, his passion for her is rekindled. She is ecstatic upon recognizing him, although she has been sworn to chastity. If she breaks her vow, she will die. Layla recalls to Nurabad, the priest, that as a child she had helped a fugitive who had given her a beautiful necklace. The veiled priestess meets Nadir in secret, but they're discovered by Nurabad, who calls for Zurga. He tears off Layla's veil and is enraged. Overwhelmed with jealousy, he's ready to have the two executed. Layla asks that her necklace be sent to her mother. Zurga recognizes the necklace. He is the fugitive whom she had saved years before. The lovers are ascending a funeral pyre when the fishermen see a red light in the distance. Zurga has set the village on fire. Once the villagers have rushed away to save their homes, Zurga helps the lovers to escape. Okay, that's Pearl Fishers, just to remind all of you. John, tell us about the appeal of this piece, because it really does go so far beyond the duet.
Oh, well, good evening, everyone. What occurred to me as I was really analyzing the piece and preparing it for this production was the fact that, you know, there are operas that are dramas, that are real music dramas, and then there are operas that are kind of dramatic rituals. And this one is a ritual. It's very different from, say, Carmen, which we'll talk about later, which is an act of drama which you really feel where there's movement in that way. Operas like Aida or Parsifal or The Magic Flute, Fidelio, these are a series of kind of stop scenes, tableau vivant, that take the audience through some process. It's like you are a congregation as well as an audience. So you have an opera with three principal characters in it. I mean, there's the fourth one is the priest, and he more or less watches the way priests frequently in Verdi operas do. So you have three people, and a little bit like Così fan tutte, where you have four people and two people watching them, you get the kind of play of A, B, and C, so it's A and B have the duet, and then C arrives, and then B sings the aria to C, and then C, B, and you mix these things up, and by the time you get to the end, each of the main characters has to give up what he or she vowed they would do. They have to give up their vow in order to move to the next level, which is to say that our baritone has to give up his tremendous affection for his friend, as well as his love for this woman who saved his life, in order for them to live happily ever after. So it becomes almost like a symbolic journey for us to experience while it's also being extremely beautiful. So the expectation should be more like it's Aida or Parsifal than that it's like Carmen.
I wanted to say a bit about what it takes to sing these roles, and then we'll talk about them dramatically. We'll talk about the orchestra, chorus, etc. Nicole, how do you classify Layla? Is she a lyric soprano? Is she a coloratura? Is she a combination of the two?
Well, it's been done by, I think, just about every type of soprano. It has a very strange requirement, which, of course, is similar to many other operas, La Traviata, Juliette, and the Gounod, Romeo and Juliet, which is sort of the three-voice requirement. Coloratura soprano in the beginning, sort of moving into a romantic lyric soprano in the middle, and eventually becoming almost a dramatic soprano, and the orchestration changes accordingly as well. I, of course, my voice is somewhat light, and so the beginning part seems like it would be a good fit, but I actually really prefer the meatier parts of the role. So, yeah, my favorite actually is Zorga and my duet in Act 3. I just love digging into it, and, you know, my singing the repertoire that I sing, you don't get that many opportunities to do that, so...
I was going to ask you about that, because suddenly she becomes very gutsy in a way that we wouldn't have expected if we just thought about what she's sounding like at the beginning.
That's right, yeah. It's, you know, this is, of course, a matter of life and death, and she just does everything she can do, and when she realizes it's for nothing, and she's, you know, Zorga actually attempts to attack her, then... She really, her guts, her personality really, I think, come out, and she loses it for, you know, a little while and curses him, and it's just wonderful. So,
Eric, your aria in the first act, I think, is one of the most exquisite pieces that a tenor would sing in the entire French repertoire. What has made that piece such a favorite of performers, especially in the early decades of the 20th century, when not just the greatest French tenors were recording it and singing it on stage, but Caruso, who was actually the first person to sing this opera at the Met? What was the appeal of it?
Well, I think it has everything a great tenor aria needs. It has a great tune. It has perfect high notes. It's not very complex as far as the accompaniment and what's going on. I mean, you think of all the great tenor arias, whether it's La Donna Mobile or Nessun Dorma. I mean, everyone can just sing the tune. And this is a very, very singable tune. And, I mean, to me, it's pretty simple. I think that's what it is.
There's a high C that some people sing and some people don't. Is it written?
No.
What's
it written for, John? What instrument is it?
Oh, the English horn.
Is it the horn? Yeah.
Yeah, the English horn.
Yeah.
Which is neither English nor a horn. It's just called it.
Now, in that, not just in that aria, actually, but in many other portions of the role, you're called upon to do what the French called voix mixte. Mm. Now, can you explain to the audience what this means and what that asks of you technically?
Well, it literally just means mixed voice. And this was, in my opinion, this was essentially how tenors were singing through the first couple hundred years of operatic history. I mean, it wasn't until really the late 19th century with Dupré and Nourry that tenors started actually singing in their chest voice, and what we all now expect a tenor high note to sound like was not at all what someone would have expected to hear in 1850, let's say. They would have heard something like what I will hopefully attempt to do in the aria, which is to mix the registers between the chest voice and the head voice. And this was a lot easier to do in houses the size that Bizet and others were writing for, about 1,000 seats, a little more than that maybe. So in a 3,500-seat house, this becomes a little difficult. But nonetheless, I think that's basically what it is. And a lot of the French repertoire demands this sort of approach to singing. And unfortunately, it's sort of gone by the wayside. A lot of people now think that tenors are cheating if they're not singing all of it in their chest voice. And it's really not the point. I think the point is to sing beautifully. So
when that kind of sound is called for in this music, at what sort of point dramatically, I mean, what sort of effect do you think is intended? Is it always a sort of dreamy kind of moment that you use that in?
Well, certainly in the aria. And there are a few other moments, but I think essentially, I remember I had a voice teacher early on that just said, why are you screaming? Why aren't you singing like you're singing to your 8-month-old baby? And I think of that being the real point, and that is to sing the way that we all would sing if we were singing to our lover, to whomever it might be, delicately, sensitively. There's especially like in the Liederabend, for instance, no one's screaming and yelling at the top of their lungs. They're just saying what they want to say beautifully, and I think that's absolutely what Bizet was trying to achieve, especially in that aria.
Now, Nathan, when you think about the vocal side of Zurga, where does he sort of stack up in terms of the rest of your repertoire? We've heard you in Mozart, we've heard you in Rossini, you do a lot of contemporary opera. Where does he sort of fit?
Hi, everybody. Where does he fit? You know, the what's different, to be as simplistic about it as possible, what's different about Zurga than all these other characters that I do on stage, is he has, what I notice the most, he sustains the same note over and over and over again. It's like the recit for him is just one note. Maybe Bizet never thought he could write a real recit, but it's just like one note over and over and over, and then he goes up a half step and sings that note over and over and over. And, trying to make that dramatic sense out of that is a little bit tricky at times. Trying to make that have meaning that everybody can understand. So that is different. Where it lies, for me, it's, I'm a lyric baritone, so I kind of feel like whatever I sing lyrically. That's what I do. It does have, which is wonderful, our little meaty duet at the end where you really get to, and go at each other and curse each other and be thwarted and thwart and all that. But what I do notice is that as I continue through the opera, at the beginning of the third act, I have this beautiful aria that is the golden mean, if you will, of his experience and his journey in this particular story, and it's a very lyric, beautiful piece, and it's not done very often.
No, we were talking about that. Yeah. Why it isn't sung more often? It's just
In auditions, you always get guys singing Valentin's aria from Faust,
yeah,
and nobody.
I know. And which is funny because this one at least has this aria where he's trying to come to terms. He's just out of anger condemned the man who he loves the most like a brother to death, and Layla, I guess, as well. Both of them, because she comes in begging later for his life and to spare his life and not hers. But so his journey is, do I act as the statesman here and follow the law, even though I know it's not right to do what I've decided to do out of anger, or do I reverse myself? And that's a defining moment for who he is. And we can all kind of relate to that on a minor scale. Valentin, he's singing goodbye to his sister. I mean, in a really passionate way.
Well, it's a really good tune. I think
it's a great tune, no doubt.
That's why.
It's a bit dated.
But I would say that what Nathan's talking about is the crux of why the opera is so attractive, because it's a lesson. You see, because all of these operas are generally written by people who grew up in the Judeo-Christian society of Europe. So whether it's Rossini or whether it's Wagner or whether it's Bizet, it really has a fundamental point. And the point is through him. He's the one who has to give up and sacrifice himself just for some greater good, mm-hmm, for the two people he loves in the world by never seeing them again.
Right.
And that's what this aria is. He's struggling with that. And so he becomes us at that moment.
That's right. And he has found... did all of you see Billy Budd when it was here or seen it before? The decision that Captain Veer has to make, and where he's going to follow the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law, even though he knows it's the wrong thing to do, he does it anyway. Zurga does the opposite. He decides he can't follow the letter of the law. He's going to, because he realizes he'll lose himself in the process. And so he decides to follow the spirit. And that's, we'll talk about this probably. It's an extraordinary story. It is a great story. It's that, I don't know why it's, he decided to make this, set the story where it was. What I've told myself is that they're pearl fishers because they're diving for that pearl of great price or something. That one real meaning, there has to be a symbolic meaning behind all of this, because the story itself is so fundamental and so important and such something that we all can relate to in our lives as human beings.
John, here is Bizet, who was a Frenchman in the mid-19th century, and he is attempting to bring to life this world of exotic ancient Ceylon. I mean, what can we listen for in the audience that will best communicate this feeling of exoticism?
Well, exoticism is fundamental in doing what I had talked about earlier, which is to create ritual. Because by taking the story out of your normal life, whether at Chicago or Milan or wherever the people are, put it in Ceylon, because there are probably not a lot of opera companies in Ceylon, and you put it in what now is Sri Lanka, or like in Aida, you put it in Egypt. You put it somewhere else, Turandot, you put it in China. And so that already gives us the excuse to look at it as a fairy tale of some kind. Then once the composer has seduced you into saying it's not actually here, then he can start playing with you. And by the end of it, you're changed by that experience. Now, the French have been always fascinated with exoticism. You know, that's why you have the Firebird have its premiere in Paris. It's why you think about why they so loved Aida, why they wanted certain operas by Wagner. So in this case, I don't think Bizet took a moment at that point in the 1860s to study what music from Ceylon sounded like. He just invented something that was just slightly exotic. Because just like Verdi, who had no idea what Egyptian music sounded like, to this day we have no idea what music at the time of Aida would have sounded like. We just know there were flutes and hieroglyphics. And so he just invented what was Egyptian. Just like Alex North did 100 years later when he wrote the music to the movie of Cleopatra. That's a 1960s version of fake Egyptian, and 1860s, it's an Italian version of it. In the case of this opera, it's fake whatever, Ceylonese music. So you will have a certain, the chorus mostly does that. And the phrases are sometimes 7-bar phrases or 5-bar phrases. And so they're slightly unusual. There'll be a tambourine or a gong, and that will give you that feeling of the breezes coming across the island, you know? But basically, that's really it. It's just the excuse, just the way he uses Spanish influence in Carmen. See, that's more real, because a Frenchman would have actually known what that music sounds like. But this is just the gauze. It's just the smoke and mirrors that gets you into the story.
Is it a good idea for people to just sort of forget about their experience of Carmen when they come to Pearl Fisher's?
Well, there are certain parts. I think it depends how you view Carmen. You know, if you think of Carmen as a Spanish opera, then you should forget about Carmen. Because if you think of Carmen, when you think of Carmen, you think of yum, ba-dum, dum, 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 dum. That's what you're thinking about. But if you think about Carmen, like the duet between José and Carmen in the last scene, then you will absolutely recognize the DNA of the younger Bizet. He's there all the time. There's Micaela's music sometimes in Leila's music. You'll hear some in the recitatives, in the commentary. You know, in Bizet's time, he was accused of being Wagnerian. Now, and that's interesting. And a lot of people think that that's silly. You know, how could people be that dumb? But I know you want to ask a question sometime about French style, I think, at some point. But if you think about Bizet's Carmen, the great historic recordings of Carmen, and even the great historic performances of Carmen, were not by French conductors in general. Whereas with Massenet and Gounod, they tend to be French stylistic. But when you think about Carmen, many people grew up with the Thomas Beecham recording of it with Victoria de los Angeles, or Claudio Abbado's recording, or Herbert von Karajan, or Leonard Bernstein. And I assisted Bernstein on that recording with an all-American cast, basically, except Adriana Malaponte. Why is it that international conductors have such a tremendous success with Bizet and tend not to look at Gounod and Massenet? It's because Bizet actually was so influenced by German music. And Wagner himself said that the only opera that he knew of written by a contemporary of his own that he thought was good was Carmen. And that is quite interesting. And the way you hear that Wagnerian isms, it's if you listen to the bass line, it frequently kind of snakes up. It moves in chromatic, kind of moving the way it does in Tristan. You actually will find that comfort in knowing that, and that's what's similar to Carmen, even though he was only in his 20s when he wrote this opera. It's quite interesting. We keep finding more and more, as it were, Carmenisms in it.
You were talking about Micaela's aria before, which is something that we heard Nicole sing just a few weeks ago. Can you talk about where Leila fits in relation to that character and also to Juliet, which is also in your repertoire.
Right. Well, again, with Juliet, the whole role sort of mirrors Juliet's role. Not dramatically, vocally more so, but yes, with the Micaela aria, it is, well, I just find that it's more dramatic. I don't know why. I think that the role is required to be a little bigger. Am I wrong to say that the orchestration's even thicker in that, or
in
it
the,
just
in
seems...
The, you mean in the big aria?
In the Micaela's aria.
Well, it's kind of similar in the sense that you have the horn calls at the end and all of that. If you think about that, it's...
But it was funny. I was watching a YouTube video. Iliana Kotrubash was giving a lesson to somebody on Judy, and she says, no, sing it like this. Me voilà seule. Now, this is the Leila's aria, and the girl's kind of, you know, okay, and she sings the Micaela, you know, and no, sing it like this. And Iliana again sings the Leila's piece, and you know, it's so she finally figures out, oh wait, that's the other one. They're so similar. I mean, they're very similar recitative, similar A section. The B section is, you know, pick up in tempo, change of rhythm, almost exactly
very,
the same.
Very similar.
And then, of course, it repeats with slight variations. And again, is it a coda at the end is also extremely similar. So it's a lower placed, I find, for Micaela, and it's just a little bit more dramatic.
Does Leila give you anything like the kind of scope emotionally that Juliet would give? I mean, what is Leila allowed to express emotionally in the course of the role?
Just about everything. Well, actually... take that back. She's a bit apprehensive from the very beginning because she's being she's volunteered to be a priestess, to give up certain rights and certain freedoms. And from the very beginning, she's afraid because this is a very big decision she's made. And she is happy, you know, and she's singing her first aria. She's happy because... you know, what she's singing is a beautiful thing, and she believes in what she's singing, and the imagery is pleasant to her. So you get a little bit of that, but come to think of it, you know, generally from that point forward, it's grief and struggle.
Well, she's in love with somebody, and she's giving up that possibility, and he shows up very quickly.
Well,
very
and her resolve very quickly goes away. Yeah, and Juliet, of course, she has, you know, quite a bit more music where she's allowed to be young, where she's allowed to show real, true, innocent happiness. And I really enjoy singing Juliet, but I'd say this is a close second. You know,
I just want to say one other thing, that the other interesting thing about her role, which we haven't pointed out, is that Leila is like Micaela, but in this third act duet, there's a place with a timpani role where she basically gives the same line that Carmen gives to José, where Carmen says, okay, then kill me or let me go. You know, there's this great moment where Carmen says, frappez-moi donc ou laissez-moi passer. And it exactly is so she turns from being a Micaela into being a Carmen in that duet. And she becomes one of the strongest female characters in all of opera. And surprisingly enough, she's not sacrificed at the end like all those other girls.
Yay!
And she also, at one point, she tells Zorga at the end of the duet that she hates him. And it gets very...
She does. And it really, I think she hits a low blow because right after she says, I curse you, I hate you, and I love Nadir.
I love your best friend. My favorite part in that whole duet is this point where, and I just think it's so operatic and so just perfect, is when finally Zurga confesses. She's like, why is he acting like such a jerk? I just told him all this wonderful news about, by the way, they both lie to me from the very beginning. So she's lying to me now too about, you know, about him not meeting her secretly on purpose. And she, you know, and he says, what, you know, what's going on? Why is he acting so bad? And finally confesses, I'm jealous, just like him, I love you. And she goes, ah!
She doesn't give up on
so it's
doesn't...
a bad reaction, you know. Of course you'll get upset about that.
Bad date.
It's like, you know, right,
Nathan?
It was a bad date.
Will
you go out with me? No.
There's not enough time in the music for her to say, oh, you are? Well, let's talk about this.
Yeah. It's more like, you're disgusting. Get away from me. Yeah.
Nicole, you were talking before about the aria and the imagery in the aria, but I don't think we really said what's going on in that aria.
Hmm. Well, she's afraid, of course, to be. she's out in the, you know, altar there at probably a very late point in the evening, all alone, scared, cold, freaked out. She keeps, I believe she's, you know, having illusions. And right as she's about to really lose it, she just imagines that Nadir is present. And she basically sings in the aria that she is comforted by knowing that he's here. I'm on the fence whether or not she really has faith that he's actually there, because she is very surprised when she actually sees him. But through the whole aria, she's singing, "He's there. He's close to me. He's hiding in the shadows, and that gives me comfort." And I think it's just the idea of him. But there's a little part of her that, you know, maybe she it would
he's
make her feel
there.
Really good if she, yeah, if she.
And by the way, this other thing about this libretto, when we tell that story, because when you tell the story in like 1 minute flat, it kind of sounds funny. But one of the nice things about this libretto is it's about singing. I mean, she is hired to be the priestess with the mostess, with whatever, you know, it because she sings to them at night. She sings to them to guard them. So music is a fundamental aspect. Music and dancing. In fact, when you enter, you say, "I'm awfully sorry to, you know, to disturb your singing and dancing." This is a culture that's built on the religiosity of dancing and singing. And she becomes the singing agent that protects the pearl fishers. And there's something kind of wonderful that she's actually been asked, not only because she's beautiful, which they can only assume because she's veiled, but because she sings to them. And you'll hear the men in the distance listening to her and singing as she's singing, and it's really quite wonderful. And that's also what makes Eric so excited to hear her voice, because it's her voice that attracts everybody.
Now, Eric, when we first see Nadir, he is returning to the pearl fishers after being away for quite some time. Well, so what was he doing with himself?
He was
off on his travels, or?
Yeah, I sort of think of this as Hermann Hesse wrote this book, Narcissus and Goldmund. And I sort of think of him like Goldmund in this moment, where he leaves and he's just having his phase, like every young man has. When we leave the nest and we go out, and we call that college. And but he's out and hunting and fishing and doing whatever he does in the woods. And I mean, that to me is sort of, it symbolizes his journey from being a boy to a man. I mean, not to be all philosophical, but that's sort of what I think of as that time away.
And what do you think of as far as his coming back? Does he just miss Surgad? He wants their sort of...
Well, this isn't... I mean, I sort of interpret it as... I don't even know if Surgad knows... He's maybe come across these people. I think it's a chance sort of an encounter, and that I stumble on these people and they bring me in chained. Well, I guess I'm not chained, but I'm at swords and such. They have found me and are bringing me into their camp, and it's just a sort of chance encounter with Surga. So we're not actually playing it as if I know where I'm returning to.
I see.
It's because that's the ritual part. What do you think?
Well, see, I don't think there's anywhere in the libretto that set, I think the pearl fishers, what that's about, is not about us. I think it's about the camp. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think he's returning home. I think they were, if you get the story at the beginning that she tells about a fugitive, I think they were both fugitives. Yeah. And I think they're in a foreign land, and you have them, I mean, they're tight. They grew up together. They're like brothers. Mm-hmm. They're escaping together. They rely on each other for their survival. They get separated. Surgad gets helped by this one girl and gives her the necklace that he eventually recognizes later. And during this time together, they end up falling in love with the same woman. And instead of pursuing her, they vow not to. And they go their separate ways because their relationship's been divided. You break that vow and pursue her anyway. I go a different direction. I decide to comfort myself by moving into a community, a place he's about law and he's about justice and about civilization. And then the wilderness.
I mean,
you,
I've certainly been pursuing her the entire time.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Come forward, and I welcome you into this. I say, embrace our laws. And
yeah.
Because there's a moment where he says, you know, what's going on? Why are you so excited about this boat arriving? And I explain that there are these old traditions here because he doesn't know about it. He's never been here before. So we're both foreigners introduced, which makes it also very significant that Zorgaz elected the chief, possibly again, we're doing it as if he's being reelected, sort of, in this community. And so all of their, you know, it's interesting because their relationship is now, rather than just being like brothers, their relationship's based on fidelity and trust and vows, and that's what causes the difficulty. That's, I mean, you know, I don't know if that's considered, you know, a common opinion about this. I just, you know, looking
well,
into this libretto, I think...
Well, it's great, because that's why we're talking about the ritual thing, because they actually represent two aspects of a masculine personality.
Absolutely.
The one who's the hunter and the one who is the lawgiver. And they're friends, but they've become two aspects of the masculine personality.
I think that's why I brought up the Hesse book.
No, you're right.
Because that's what I think of them as
I think Carl Jung would really enjoy parsing out this opera, because it, you know, the masculine act, the feminine, and then you have to give up part of it so that the feminine and masculine end up together, and it's very simple in that sense. But that's why it's so moving, because the work is has such empathy. The reason why you will love this opera is because it doesn't take sides against any of these people.
It doesn't.
It's completely...
It doesn't at all.
And there are no villains in this opera.
And none. And in a sense, Zurga, who is this, is trying to make these two fit in the world that works for him, and he know it doesn't work. So in a sense, he's responsible for their downfall. And I think that's why he decides, I can't let this happen.
Right.
And...
He lets them live.
He lets them live, and he follows. And in order to not destroy himself, he has to follow his own laws, which means someone has to be sacrificed, and it's going to be him.
Yeah,
it's actually very complicated and interesting. It's not just about a bunch of fishermen who like to catch pearls, and you know. I mean, it's really
can
not.
We continue with that though? I mean, Zorga is clearly the most complex of the three of them, and where does that complexity come from? Is he uncomfortable with his power? I know after he's elected, you know, chief of the pearl fishers, or does he embrace it?
I would say he embraces it.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah, that's who he is.
Yeah, I think that's. I think he's. I like also the. I really believe he's not from that village. He could have even created the village, as far as we know. But I don't think he's from it. And I think the fact that his authority is recognized, and he's made the chief, is an example of this really suiting him very well. And he wants the entire group, he feels responsible for all of them, and he wants them all to be safe when they, you know, this one pearl fishing sequence, what's going on, that's how they make their livelihood. It's this one act. It has to be successful or they'll have no money. Their kids will starve, you know, something bad will happen. The whole village could be destroyed. So he takes it very seriously that he is the one who's going to ask this person who's going to protect the fishermen to, or the pearl fishers to accept the vows that they're putting upon, you know, they're putting upon her in order for all of this to happen. Right? I think he takes it very seriously. I think he's very comfortable.
And remember, it's really dangerous to dive for pearls. I mean, the real title should be The Pearl Divers, because they're not just fishers. They actually have to go down to the bottom of the sea. If you think about actually what they're doing, it's extremely dangerous. I would also like to say that the idea that they elect a leader in the first scene is going to be particularly interesting on November 4th, which is our last performance. And I'm not so sure what's going to happen. I said to somebody, I said, well, half the audience will be drunk and the other half of the audience will be drunk. I mean, because...
Everybody have the radio swearing in the middle of the show.
John, I wanted to go back to the music for a minute and to talk about this style. I mean, outside of France, French style is so sort of elusive for so many performers. So how is the sound that you are after in this piece from your orchestra and from your singers, for that matter, different from... say, Italian works from the same period, whether we're talking about, you know, Don Carlo or Forza del Destino, which were written at close to the same time?
Well, one of the things that I said earlier, which makes it, in a funny way, easier and harder to do Bizet, is that he is truly an international composer. He's less French than what we call French composers, because clearly, if you when you hear the music, sometimes when you hear the music played on the piano without singers, you start to hear the influences of Chopin, the influence of Beethoven, the influence of early Wagner in this music. It's very strong, even though at one point there is a kind of a can-can when the chorus sings, yup, da 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 diddle da da diddle whoop, but then you can sort of see the girls at the Moulin Rouge, even though we're in Ceylon. But there's a whole...
That's when you've been drinking.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. But basically, because he's a dramatist, you accompany it like you would accompany anything else. But because the orchestration... now, what you should know, too, is that when Bizet died and Carmen became this world phenomenon, and it took over the entire world, and everybody knows the story that at the world premiere it was considered a failure, and Bizet died shortly after, there was this desire to find out, wow, this guy Bizet, he wrote this in that fantastic opera. Let's find out what else he wrote. And the only opera that managed to fulfill expectations was The Pearl Fishers. So it was found. Now, by the time we get to the early 20th century, a lot of the opera had been cut to make it a shorter opera. When it was restored, and we're doing basically a complete performance of The Pearl Fishers, it's not that long, but it puts all the shape, for example, in there in the duets we've been talking about. Some of that music is not orchestrated by Bizet because the actual manuscript doesn't exist anymore. So part of what I've been doing is actually thinning out that orchestration to make it congruent with the rest of the piece. You know, you look at how Bizet uses trombones, how he uses the harp, how he uses the trumpet, and making it consistent. Because that's really, you know, as Eric said earlier, the voix mixte is a one thing to do in a small theater in Paris with 1,000 seats. To do that in a 3,500 seat theater, we're already always translating. How do you make this gesture work in a large hall? One of the big changes I've made in the orchestration has to do with the notes and the timpani. Now, for those of you who don't know this, you know, the timpani in the time of Bizet would have been able to really play only one note at a time, because to tune it, you had to use a key all around the top to change the tension on the head. Nowadays, we have chromatic timpani, so that by moving a foot pedal, a little bit like when you drive with the clutch, you can change that tension and change the pitch. In Bizet's time, the timpani had a very little ring to it, because it was a skin that was a real natural skin, and you were playing in a little hall. So it sounded a little bit like if you played on a Kleenex box. It didn't have the kind of brom sound. The result is that Bizet used it more as a percussion instrument than as a real sound, a pitch. So the pitches are all wrong frequently, so that, you know, the timpani will be playing a C, but the bass note is an F sharp. So what we've actually done, because it is ludicrous, you have to make the decision: are you going to play those notes and then ask the timpanist to just really play so quietly that you can't hear him, or are you going to go more toward the where Bizet was when he was writing Carmen a number of years later? I've opted for the latter. I decided that it's stupid to fulfill those, as it were, wrong notes, since we're in a huge hall and since we are with modern timpani. And so those changes are made. Basically, other than that, it's exactly the piece, and we accompany people. We ask the violins to play with a lighter bow. We play less loudly on the brass, but on the other hand, we know that Bizet was looking for that German sound. And quite frankly, if you listen to Carmen and not the Spanish stuff with no singers, in fact, if you get a recording of Carmen sung in German, which you can do, you suddenly hear how Wagnerian it is. I mean, write the last line that José sings, Ma Carmen adore, da 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 di, da da da, that's Tristan and Isolde. It's exactly, you know, in other words, he literally quotes from the love death of Tristan and Isolde, and it goes all the way through that score. So Bizet is an international composer who happens to be French, and so you have to keep that in mind.
Thank you. Nicole and Eric, I wanted to go back to your characters for a moment and talk about the love between these two. I mean, is it based on anything, or is it just chemistry? I mean, what can we say about this relationship? I mean, they're not on stage together all that much, but they do have a love duet.
And a great one at that.
Right.
It might be my favorite music in the whole piece, except, yeah. Well, my aria, of course.
what is going on in that love duet? Is there much more textually going on other than I adore you, or is there something particularly characterful and particularly descriptive that they're saying to each other?
I mean, well, the whole beginning part, at least, is get out of here. You're in the wrong place, the wrong time. You know, there's still time to save your life, my life, if you just leave. But, you know, he says... When the duet proper begins, you know, you haven't felt the way I've felt.
Your heart didn't understand mine, yeah.
Yeah, well, and she says, yeah, it did.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it did. Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it takes, after she says this at the same time, he goes, is this true? Is this true? I mean, it's like, what did they have exactly? I mean, it's a good question, and perhaps we should talk about this more, but, you know, it makes me think they had one of those summer loves that was actually short, but so intense that it was, you know, obviously it was intense enough to convince her to accept the fate of death and for him to break that incredible vow that he made.
Well, actually, I think of it as sort of, he's the only one who's not asking something of her throughout this piece. Everyone is demanding her virginity and for her to sing for everyone, to protect them. And he's protecting you. He sees your soul. He loves you. And I think everyone else there is basically saying, look, we need you to do all these things for us. Thank you very much. And by the way, don't have sex with anybody.
Yeah, but... But he's also saying, look, you know, please give me a chance, give me a chance. No, get out of here. No, I'm asking this of you too. So he is protecting her, absolutely. But he also, I think, it's because he knows who she truly is. That
of course.
He's, you know, he's... yeah, I mean, he wants her to, you know, run away with him.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know, so. Now, when Zurga saves your lives, does Bizet or do the librettists give you a chance to say thank you, Zurga, for saving us?
No, we just say goodbye. Just say adieu.
They go, oh my God, well, bye. That's what they say. Ah,
see ya.
No, well, actually, I think that's right. I think that the denouement is really fast and really right, because at that point, the ritual is over. He's done what he has to do. Remember, I mean, there are two ways to look at this. You can ask the questions about their motivations and how they love each other, and that might help us as singers and as performers. But in ritual storytelling, it doesn't matter what their backstory is, actually. And it's very chaste, you understand, that this is not like Tristan, Act 2, which actually you could argue is also chaste, but the two of them, he comes to her, he does not really touch her, he just says, I love you, I love you. And the most you'll see is that you fondle her hair, and you know, they're caught not in flagrante delictu, but, you know, necking a little bit.
One little kiss.
And as you said, yes,
well,
that's right.
By Bollywood standards, that would be illegal.
Yeah, that's so. Right.
Nathan, you had touched a little bit on what's going on in your aria, but how is it structured emotionally? Are there particular peaks that you go through? And what ultimately is going on with him in the course of I think it's the most moving moment of the entire opera.
It is. Yeah, it's a big point. It begins at the beginning of the third act, and the very beginning of the third act is a big storm outside, which is representative of what's going on inside Zurga. Or, you know, or maybe since he is sort of a civilized, you can look at this a lot of different ways, but since he does represent civilization, all of a sudden he's now part of nature. Something's happening, something's changing that is out of his control, and it's a big storm. And so he compares himself to it a bit, you know, finally this anger that he felt. The reason why he's condemned him to death was not because he was following his own law, which he wished he would have been. He condemned him to death out of anger. And he realizes now that he's calm, as he's calmed down and that has passed, that he has, you know, condemned to death his best friend. And that's what the very beginning of this aria is about. He's singing to Nadir. And talking about how he's such a wonderful friend of his, and he can't eventually, in the middle of it, he says, I can't, you know, how could this have happened? it's impossible that all of this could have happened. And you know what the truth is? If I tell myself the truth is that I'm the one responsible for him and I'm the one responsible for his death. It's not the law. It's me because of my own anger. And then he moves back into this lovely, tender song of you know, of fidelity and caring to Nadir, and he adds Layla to it and her beauty. He combines the two of them, and
it's worthy of Verdi. You know, it's absolutely the idea that Bizet was in his 20s and wrote this thing in like 3 weeks or something or other is just amazing. What comes in his aria, and that is quite Wagnerian too, because the bass line keeps moving up chromatically while he's doing this, and it is extraordinary, and it's worthy. It's a situation worthy of the greatest moments in Verdi on every level.
It is. It's a real, and in the end of the aria, he asks for both of their forgiveness. And that's when she comes in after that.
Which is why I said the Judeo-Christian thing, because it becomes very much that, a confessional, and it's quite extraordinarily powerful.
I don't think we can get away without talking about the duet, at least briefly. So
duet.
You've both done the roles on stage. Mm. I'm curious as to how... whether you've had any very interesting, very moving even responses from people in talking about it, because I know people whose lives have changed because of this music. I mean, people who didn't care about opera before and then heard the Pearlfishers duet and suddenly were rabid opera fans.
Yeah.
Do you get that kind of response in people when you sing this music?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost, you know, it's such a famous duet, and the people who really love it, you can hear it throughout, you know, the entire piece in different places. And you know, I was one of those people at the beginning, the first time, you know, I started, you know, studying opera and I heard that duet, I thought, wow.
Me too.
You know, it's always the Merrill Beerling recording. You're just like, holy smokes, this is
gorgeous.
Wish I could
sound like Beerling.
What's the rest of that opera sound like? Oh, don't listen to it. Just listen to the duet. It's great. But what's, you know, it's interesting now is that, you know, my ears have adjusted so much. They've changed after having sung it, that I don't hear it in the same way anymore. And for me, it's turned into this story, and it's not just a beautiful tune. It's a coming together of two men that have been separated for so long. It's a reaffirmation of vows, and it's a journey into. It's a reliving of the experience that caused the strife at the beginning. And if you think about what they're saying, you can see how that takes place.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the duet, they're really sort of they're contentious, and there's a lot of strife between them. And then slowly, you know, with a simple word, you know, Zurga, don't you remember this? Come on, I know who you are. I know you're the big chief right now, but let's talk as friends with our first names, and then. He admits to having remembered all this, even though Zurga pretends like he doesn't know anything about it.
Seeing Layla is what you're talking about. Right?
About seeing, yes, yeah. Right. He doesn't realize it's, you know, her at that point. And then they re-experience you for the audience, and it's so wonderful because you get this beauty in this duet that expresses the beauty of this woman, the sound of her voice, how she looked when she lifted her veil. That's the cause of all the problem.
Yeah,
and it's really smart because, you know, it's what makes it so smart in every way is that this duet comes in about 10 minutes into the first act.
Yeah.
It's not like Une Belle Dee where you have to wait till act two of Madame Butterfly, right? It comes right there. And, you know, that is really a dangerous thing to do for a composer, to throw that card out right there. And then what is so smart, and that's why they called it Wagnerian, was that he keeps quoting it right up to 30 seconds before the end of the opera itself, where there's the memory of that, where the tenor and the soprano are actually united. And that idea of memory being captured, we participate in their memory when we hear them sing that duet, right? We weren't there, but now we're part of that memory. And then each time it's quoted for the next 2.5 hours, and it's not quoted that often, maybe 3 or 4 times, I've never counted it, but right up to the end, we all participate and understand and forgive. And that's actually the big deal. It is a transformative work.
And one other thing that happens in the duet that's wonderful is at the beginning of the duet, when you get the first of the tune, they're describing this woman that they say has broken them apart. And by the end of the duet, they realize, no, she hasn't broken us apart. She's the thing that's united us right now. And then it brought us back together. She's the thing that brings us together now in this community, and everything's going to be okay. And then by the end of the opera, you realize in the same tune that her purpose was even beyond that. Her purpose was to save Zurga from himself and to bring them together. The purpose was not to divide them, but was actually, they all had a destiny that was united. And you find out what that is in the end. It's not what it seems at the beginning. Isn't that, I mean, it's an interesting journey, right?
It absolutely is. I just have to tell a story quick about my dad, because my dad is such a blue-collar, military guy who's not a huge opera fan at all. And he just loves his tune. He sings it all the time. And he does. And he said to me once, you know, what I like so much about that moment is that it sort of symbolizes what men go through when they fight a war, and this bond that men can have. And it's sort of, to me, this music symbolizes that so perfectly, that no matter what happened, no matter what came before, we will still always be brothers, we'll still be bound together by this beautiful bond. And for me, I just always think of my dad and the stories that he tells about Vietnam and these friends that he still sees once a year, and this beautiful connection, no matter what happened and what still happens, they're just connected. And so the last page, I mean, I just get emotional thinking about it even right now. It just is such a beautiful expression of this, of male love. I don't know why, but and I think, what the story and all this apart, that's, I think, essentially what we feel when we hear this. What?
No.
Come get a ticket.
We haven't talked at all about how you all are directed on the stage, and especially in terms of movement. Is there anything that you are being asked to do on stage that very much belongs to this vision of Salon? Especially you, Nicole, are you... how have you been directed as far as the way she sort of comports herself on the stage?
Well, it's very forgiving directing. I mean, we're allowed to sing instead of, you know, roll around on the ground and do ridiculous things. In terms of maybe something that would be representative of this particular location, and I mean, I would think only... my prayer, I have a prayer to Brahma, the statue of Brahma. And
does she sculpt the air with her arms as she sings, that kind of stuff?
I mean, honestly, it's a beautiful thing, because I can stand on my altar and sing, and really it's just that. There's no sort of ritualistic choreography or dances or anything that we're involved in.
The three of you don't do any dancing in this.
Oh, we dance.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, you
do. Oh, well, yes, I've seen
you dance.
I wouldn't
call that dancing. Maybe
10 seconds.
It's more than I dance, James.
I dance, he doesn't.
Yeah, I'm not a dancer.
You know, there's one very important element of this piece that we haven't mentioned yet, John, and that is the chorus. What is their role in this piece?
Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier that they supply some of that kind of exotic nature, but they have some really great choruses to sing. And you know, this is an interesting, every opera has different qualities about it when you work on them, when you actually rehearse them. And one of the things about this opera is that it's very easy to rehearse, in the sense that there are just three principals in the room, and then come the times when the chorus comes in and suddenly there's 80 people in the room. And they have phenomenally interesting things to do. Their music is usually dance oriented, and they do some dancing, by the way. But also, by the time you get to the last chorus in the second scene of the third act, that music almost predicts, you know, Night on Bald Mountain. There's a certain kind of violence also in their music that I think is really, must have been very powerfully attractive to the French audience. The French audience always, you know, they like scandal. You're always reading about histories of premieres in Paris where there's a scandal, whether it's the Rite of Spring or whatever it is. It's a scandal, and then everybody wants to go see it. Carmen was a scandal. So there's a certain kind of I think of the violence that's under this music, that's where you'll find it. And the other thing that Nathan was just talking about nature, that's the other wonderful image in this opera, because music and dance is part of nature. And when there's a storm, it means something is wrong. When the moon comes out, when the sky is blue, it means everything's all right. So the chorus will sing, "The sky is blue." I mean, the sky is blue, it's a very simple line. It may look like a dopey thing to set to music, but it's completely beautiful and completely honest. See, what we're doing is performing it completely honestly. You know, Herb Kellner is directing it. It's physically a completely new production, whether you know that or not, and it really looks like an opera. I mean, this is one opera that absolutely looks like an opera. And I was also going to say to you is that I've been thinking about how much, and I have no idea the answer to this, this opera influenced Verdi in Aida, because just like Aida, you know, a man is chosen to be a leader in the first scene. And in Aida, there are two women who are vying for one man. And in this opera, there are two men who are vying for one woman. And only through sacrifice of one, you know, you see her Amneris at the end, and the two, as it were, they die. But, you know, you don't sense that they're dying. You sense that they're being together forever, just as you sense this. And it's very much like that. And I think that's one of the things that, for those of you who are seeing this opera for the first time, will make you feel comfort in it, because it is very much of that style of tableau vivant.
Yeah, thank it is you. Very tableau. Yeah, that's true. It's a series of pictures that you get rather than kind of. It's not very movie-like.
Right.
Like a lot
it's
of
not,
things
it's
are
not,
today.
That's what I say. It's not. It's not an action opera. No. It's a ritual opera.
It's great.
Now, before we open the floor for a couple of questions, I just want to ask the two guys, our Nadir and our Zurga, who would you rather have your daughter date, Nadir or Zurga?
I don't have any daughters. I mean,
definitely not. Yeah, definitely Zurga.
Yeah, all right.
Absolutely.
Do we have any questions from the audience? Yes. The question is, Nicole has decided against singing particular repertoire at this time, and could you comment on repertoire choices?
Sure. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, I have a light lyric soprano voice, and my hopes and prayers will be one day to move on to middleweight lyric soprano, never dramatic, and Aida, Tosca, these are some of my favorite roles, but unfortunately they're dramatic soprano. Franny is, you know, recorded some great roles with not the hugest voice, but singing even in a live house, an opera house, 3,000 seats, it's kind of impossible for a voice my size. So you never know. Maybe the gods will bless me and increase my voice twofold, and I'll be able to do some of these things I want. But for the time being, this is a perfect fit for me. I like this.
Any other questions? Right here.
This is one of the few casts that we've seen that's all American performers. Is there something special about that, all working together?
The question
well, we're all planning to vote on November 4th.
John, is it unusual to find a piece of this kind in the French repertoire, which is sung by all-American casts, or do you get more and more of that these days?
I think you get more and more of that. You know, I think we went through different periods. For example, there was a time when most Wagnerian operas were all American cast too, and you'd find them in Germany. So, I mean, there's a huge, we have a huge, extraordinary country, and as you pointed out earlier, I'm chancellor of a university, and we have a music school in that, and you know the conservatories in America are the greatest conservatories in the world, so it only makes and that we are and have been for you know a good 75 years, so it makes sense that we are training the best opera singers in the world, and they're wanted all over the world, and that's what we're finding. We're finding that this is a good example of where education in our country is actually working in our favor.
Yeah. We've exceeded our time. I just want to thank our entire panel. This is wonderful.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.